High in the Pyrenees Mountains, in between France and Spain, sits the tiny country of Andorra. Occupying a valley about the size of the city proper of Los Angeles, with only 80,000 people, Andorra is not only one of the world's smallest countries by both territory and population, it's also one of the world's most inaccessible countries, surrounded by 9,000-foot peaks on almost all sides. It is the only full United Nations member nation that has no airports, no railroads, and no seaports. Andorra has two radio stations, a ceremonial military of 12 people, a professional basketball team in the Spanish league system with the motto Som un país, meaning we are a country, which is defensible, that's easy to forget, an economy mostly based around its low taxes drawing shoppers from France and Spain, a commemorative currency called the dinar that has no real value, Andorrans use the euro in their day-to-day lives, and an entire Wikipedia page on the 75 species of ants that can be found there. It is the only country where Catalan, a language very similar to Spanish, spoken across northeastern Spain, is the official language, one of only four countries in the world that has no land below 2,500 feet in elevation, and also possibly the only place where you really can ski cross-country. Andorra's government is equally unique. It's one of just three countries that styles itself as a principality, that is, a territory ruled by a prince. The only others, Monaco and Liechtenstein, are also tiny European micronations and are among the few countries that are smaller than Andorra. In practice, though, Andorra is a democracy and one of the only countries on Earth to have a government system known as a constitutional diarchy. What is a constitutional diarchy? Well, a constitutional monarchy is a country with a political system like Britain. The official leader of the country is a king and or a queen who greets foreign heads of state and cuts the ribbon when the government builds new hospitals and airports and stuff, and they're unelected and usually pass down their title through generations of the same royal family. But they don't have much real power. The real power in a constitutional monarchy is held by a prime minister, who is elected by a group of politicians called a parliament, who are in turn democratically elected by the people of that country. There will be terms thrown around like His Majesty's Health Service and His Majesty's Schools and His Majesty's Army, but the funding for those things comes from the elected parliament. That's a constitutional monarchy. If you live in Britain or Canada or Australia or New Zealand, you live in one of those. Monarchy, because there's a monarch, one ruler, who is supposedly in charge of the whole thing, but constitutional because there's a constitution that sets out how the government should work and what the royals can or can't do. A lot of important countries are constitutional monarchies. Plenty of European countries have kings and queens, Japan's got an emperor, and Malaysia and Indonesia have individual regions that have ceremonial royals. But then there's Andorra. A constitutional diarchy. A monarchy has one royal leader. A diarchy has two separate royal leaders, technically equal as co-heads of state. So since Andorra is also a principality, the official leaders of Andorra are two co-princes. The real political power in Andorra is vested in an elected parliament called the General Council of the Valleys, led by a figure known as the General Syndic. The General Syndic, in turn, appoints a Prime Minister who is the real day-to-day leader of Andorra. But then there's the co-princes, who are unelected figures with no real equivalent in any other country. And here's where things get really weird. There's no royal family of Andorra, or two royal families. The co-princes of Andorra are the President of France and the Catholic Bishop of Urgel, a neighboring region of Spain. Andorra residents don't vote in French elections, and the Bishop of Urgel is appointed by the Archbishop of Tarragona, who is appointed by the Pope. But by ascending to either of those roles, the President of France and the Bishop of Urgel also become co-princes of Andorra, making the President of France the only person in the world who is the elected head of state of one country and the royal head of state of another. And the Bishop of Urgel, just one of two Catholic religious figures who also holds a secular political office. The only other one being the Pope himself, who is head of state of Vatican City. Probably the most famous, weird, tiny European pseudo-country. How did they get this way? Why does Andorra have two heads of state, and why are they a Catholic bishop, and the president of a foreign country. It starts way back in the time of Emperor Charlemagne of the Frankish Empire, which is sort of the predecessor of both modern-day France and modern-day Germany, in the 8th century Common Era. Charlemagne is more of a messianic founding figure to Andorrans than he is to either the French or the Germans. Andorra's national anthem is even called El Gran Charlemagne. In Charlemagne's time, the Pyrenees were part of the Marca Hispanica, a sort of medieval DMZ between the Frankish Empire and the Umayyad Muslim Caliphate, which ruled modern-day Spain and Portugal. Supposedly, Charlemagne granted some level of sovereignty to the area now called Andorra to thank the residents of the mountain valleys for fighting off a Muslim invasion, and although there's no concrete record of this, it is clear that by the 9th century, Andorra was being treated as a semi-independent entity. But this was before the modern era of nation-states, and exactly what was an independent country and wasn't was iffy. Andorra was still within the Frankish Empire and part of the territory of the Count of Urgell. In those days, the Catholic Church, of course, had a much more powerful role in secular politics, and we're so far back in European history here that you wouldn't even refer to it as the Catholic Church because it was just the Church. The split that created the Eastern Orthodox churches hadn't happened yet, and the Protestant Reformation was centuries off. It was truly small-c Catholic in the original sense of the word, universal. Other than some Oriental Orthodox Christians, different from Eastern Orthodox, in the Middle East, almost all Christians belonged to it. Under the feudal system of the Frankish Empire, all land was either owned by a secular count or a religious bishop, and in 988, the Count of Urgell exchanged some land with the Bishop of Urgell. In exchange for giving the count some fertile farmland in the foothills, the bishop got Andorra, which may or may not have been a fair trade. Now Andorra was without military protection, because only the secular authorities could raise an army. Later counts of Urgell considered taking back control of Andorra by force, since its only defenses were natural ones. So, in 1095, the Bishop of Urgell called on the Lord of Cabué, the local leader of a neighboring territory, to provide defense for Andorra, and they agreed to informally share sovereignty over the territory. Within a few generations, the descendants of the Lord of Cabué married into the aristocratic family of Foix, a sorta independent fiefdom on the French side of the mountains that was sort of also part of France. Gradually, through wars, marriages, and conquests, the royals of Foix evolved into the royal family of Navarre, a clearly independent nation in what is now northern Spain's Basque country, so now the King of Navarre was also the co-prince of Andorra. Then, in 1589, after this arrangement had been going on for hundreds of years, King Henry of Navarre became King of France through a marriage into the French royal family, followed by a victory in the French Wars of Religion. Once king, he declared that the head of state of France would be the co-prince of Andorra from there on out. And with that, the Principality of Andorra, as we know it, was born. Even as France and the Catholic Church have changed over the centuries, Andorra has stayed more or less the same. Napoleon's rampages in the early 19th century briefly made Andorra part of France, but its independence was restored in 1814. The co-princes have ruled since then, with only one interruption. That time, a dashing stranger showed up and declared himself king, and people listened. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. This is my co-host, Jollibee the Durian, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities.
We'll be right back.
By the dawn of the 20th century, precious little had changed in Andorra since its founding. In some ways, it was Europe's last feudal state. There was a parliament, but only male heads of household could vote for it, and the co-princes could reject any law the parliament passed. France saw Andorra as something of a colony. The bishop saw Andorra as an ideal little conservative Catholic utopia. The people of Andorra didn't really want to be either, but what could they do? The vast majority were farmers, paying 10% of their income to the bishop under feudal-era tax laws, and even as innovations like cars, phones, and electricity gradually made their way to the rest of the world, Andorra had none of those. There were no roads passable enough to drive cars on. There were no banks, no media, no police, no non-religious schools. Andorra was shut off from the world. When Andorra applied to join the League of Nations, a predecessor to the UN, in 1920, they rejected Andorra's application on the grounds that Andorra wasn't really an independent state. The Andorran parliament began to look for ways to develop the country. Andorra needed paved roads, no matter what. No country was going to survive the 20th century without them. But Andorra didn't have any money. What resource did they have that they could possibly exploit? Hydroelectricity. The only electricity in Andorra up to this point was produced by small, privately owned generators to power machinery at sawmills and flour mills. But they had river gorges, perfect for building dams. In 1929, the General Council of the Valleys created a hydroelectric company and sold it to a Spanish Catalan businessman. They were killing two birds with one stone. They were getting money to build transportation links to the outside world, and at the same time, they were getting electricity. But they were also opening Andorra's Pandora's box. Not a lot of countries, even ones as isolated as Andorra, have such a clearly defined first contact moment. Not a lot of places have a historical event so clearly dividing their past into before and after. We were cut off from the outside world, and then, all of a sudden, we were part of it. The dam brought modernity to Andorra in a million ways at once.
More food, and more people who came to buy the food. Now you need people to help make the food and keep track of the sales. And now you need houses for people to live in and people to make the houses. And now there's more people and they invent things, which makes things better. And more people come and there's more farming and more people to make more things for more people. And now there's business, money, writing, laws, power.
I think it's uncontroversial to say that the Industrial Revolution was probably the biggest change to come over human civilization since civilization itself. In most countries, it took lifetimes for the changes to take shape. In Andorra, it happened over a couple of years in the early 1930s, when they built a dam. The construction of the dam was overseen by Swiss technicians, while the workers were mostly rank-and-file Andorrans. Andorra had no labor laws, and the workers were treated like shit. They had no breaks, made next to nothing, and would regularly have their hours extended without warning. But as roads were hacked through the mountains, and international capital began flowing into Andorra, so did international ideas. Not only could foreigners now easily get to Andorra, as we'll see soon, Andorrans could easily go abroad. A lot of struggling Andorrans emigrated to Barcelona, the center of Catalan-speaking culture, where they sent back radical new ideas, new to Andorra at least, from the basements and bar rooms of Barcelona. All of a sudden, there were Andorran communists and Andorran anarchists, determined to fight the businessmen in charge of the dam and distribute its benefits equally. The dam builders formed Andorra's first union. The co-princes countered with Andorra's first police force. There was no putting this genie back in the bottle, especially now that Andorra's first reliable electric connection gave Andorra its first telephones, newspapers, and radio stations. Revolution was brewing in the co-principality. An organization called the Young Andorrans, formed of Andorra residents who had spent time in Barcelona and gotten caught up in the revolutionary spirit of the looming Spanish Civil War, began publishing an underground magazine, where they solicited signatures for a petition. They demanded a constitution that constrained the role of the co-princes, universal suffrage, education in Catalan instead of French or Spanish, free speech, and labor rights. The French government and the Catholic Church tried to suppress the Young Andorrans, but their popular support in Andorra was massive. On April 5th, 1933, the dam builders went on strike, drawing the attention of Andorra's tiny police force. With the cops distracted, nobody lifted a finger to stop the young Andorans when they burst into the meeting house of the Andorran Parliament and locked the parliamentarians in, holding them hostage until they approved the young Andorans' demands. They capitulated quickly. The co-princes were horrified. France sent gendarmes, military police, to crush what was now a full-scale insurrection in Andorra. But this was risky, because now Andorra was connected to the outside world. There were phones and telegraphs, and there were journalists there to cover the unrest. For the first time ever, Andorra made headlines across the world. Even Franklin D. Roosevelt voiced his concerns over what was happening in this obscure European principality. The world saw French gendarmes attacking innocent Andorrans who just wanted self-government. Overseas, in distant colonies, that sort of behavior might have been tolerated. Within Europe, in a country that was supposedly independent, it was seen as horribly unbecoming of a Western democracy. Even France's allies were calling its actions cruel and unprovoked. Backed up against a wall by the press coverage of Andorra, the president of France agreed to hold an election under universal male suffrage in Andorra. This was a janky election. Andorra had no political parties. In fact, political parties weren't officially legalized in Andorra until 1993, so every candidate ran as an independent. Therefore, exactly which group won a majority is unclear because nearly every member of parliament had a slightly different vision for the country's future. What is clear is this. The results weren't what the young Andorrans had hoped, possibly because of voter intimidation on the part of the French gendarmes who were still around, or because the voting age was 25, not 21, as the young Andorrans had requested, or just because of the voters' growing fatigue at the rapid pace of change, the conservative opposition to the young Andorrans won control of the parliament. The status quo was going to continue in Andorra, and with it, the social unrest. It was then that a stranger came to town, and at long last, curious people, it's time to talk about Boris Skocyrev. Prior to his period as King of Andorra, we don't know much about Boris Skocyrev. Most sources seem to agree that he was born in Vilnius, today the capital of Lithuania and then part of the Russian Empire, in 1896, or maybe 1898. He was a con man across Europe in the early 1900s, who regularly claimed to have connections to various European royal families and to have served as a soldier and or a spy in the service of many different countries. Some of his stories are almost definitely false, like that he was educated at Oxford's Magdalen College. Others are surprisingly likely to be true. Skocyrev is believed to have served with a mostly Irish unit of the English army on the Russian front of World War I, somehow parlaying his experience later in the war into a role as a translator at the Japanese military mission to the UK. How Skocyrev learned Japanese is unclear, but to answer a theory I know at least some of you had, it probably didn't have anything to do with the Russo-Japanese War, since he would have been elementary school age when that was happening. Skocyrev pops up next in London in 1919, getting arrested for Czech fraud. He fled the country, probably going to France, and surfaced next in 1925. When he applied for and received a Nansen passport, a document for stateless refugees in the interwar years. Most holders of Nansen passports were Russian Tsarists fleeing the Bolshevik regime, and Skocyrev is usually lumped in with them, although his political beliefs at this point were more likely along the lines of, just give me a country where I can swindle people. Around the same time, he was included on a list of, quote, prominent foreign revolutionaries drawn up by the Dutch government, even though Skocyrev hadn't been involved in any known revolutionary movements yet. In 1931, Skocyrev turned up down in Colombia, running an import-export business in the port city of Santa Marta. What he imported and exported is not recorded. The next year, he was back in Europe, living on the Spanish Mediterranean island of Mallorca, with Florence Marmon, an American millionaire heiress who had divorced the early auto industry tycoon Howard Marmon. In 1933, after being hassled by the Spanish government in Mallorca for purported involvement in cocaine running, which may explain what he was doing running an import-export business in Colombia, Skocyrev looked for places he could go next. The Great Depression had hit, and nearly every country in the Western world was suffering an economic crisis the likes of which they had never seen. But there was one country where the economy was booming for the first time in its history, and the people were restless. Skocyrev headed up to the Pyrenees to embark on his most ambitious swindle yet. The goal? A crown of his own. The mark? All of Andorra. From the wall-to-wall media coverage of the Andorran Revolution, Skocyrev knew all about the Andorrans' longing for freedom. He'd heard that the young Andorrans had plans for a constitution that would modernize the country, but it wasn't likely to pass because of the results of the parliamentary election. He spent months living in Andorra, befriending rank-and-file Andorrans, until, in May 1934, he marched into the Andorran parliament and declared that he had written a new constitution, inspired by the young Andorrans' goals and backed by the majority of the population, and he wanted to see it implemented. Skocyrev's constitution did, indeed, include the ideas that motivated the young Andorrans. Freedom of speech, full self-governance for Andorra, and other typical liberal democratic features, all sprinkled with a light dose of Catalan nationalism. But in addition to those ideas from the Andorran left, it also included something to get the right wing on board, something that hadn't been previously proposed by any of the agitators in Andorra, and something that only a con man could come up with. He was going to make Andorra a tax haven. Skocyrev had brought up this idea in his discussions with Andorran villagers, and it had been popular. He planned to raise Andorra's living standards by lowering its corporate taxes, making it into a banking hub and a place for shady characters the world over to stash their earnings. In other words, he wanted to be the con man king of con man land, and lots of Andorrans were so dissatisfied with the status quo, they went along with it. Most people wanted Andorra to be rich and independent, and Skocyrev had a plan for both. In exchange for this gift to the country, Skocyrev told the parliament he would need to be crowned King of Andorra. Plenty of Andorrans were ready to accept that, believing that anything had to be better than the co-princes. But remember, the parliament had a pro-princes majority at this point. Skocyrev was received as a madman and harshly warned not to meddle in the affairs of Andorra ever again. Within a few days, the French president intervened and kicked him out of the country. Skocyrev's first attempt had failed, but never mind that. He was going to start the Andorran government in exile. He still had support from a substantial chunk of the Andorran population, which was small enough at the time that almost everyone in the country had met him during his few months living there. From a hotel in the Spanish town of La Seu d'Urgell, right across the border, Skocyrev began to codify the trappings of the Kingdom of Andorra. He claimed descent from the French crown and a noble title from the Netherlands, which he definitely didn't really have. He published 10,000 copies of his planned constitution, 2 copies for every man, woman, and child in Andorra, and had his supporters distribute them within the country, further galvanizing support for his would-be regime. He created a flag for the Kingdom of Andorra, which consisted of Andorra's red, yellow, blue tricolor turned on its side, with a crown replacing the coat of arms on the original flag. Skocyrev also engaged in shrewd self-promotion, telling his story to all the journalists who were still flocking to Andorra. This created a feedback loop with more and more international newspapers knocking on the door of the hotel where he now lived, interested in covering the bizarre new development in Andorra's unrest. French and Spanish newspapers were harsh in their coverage, with La Información de Cádiz notably calling him un perturbado, a perturbed as in insane person, while the Anglophone world saw him as a curiosity, and Catalans saw him as a king. Although Skocyrev had claimed at various points in his past to be either Russian Orthodox or Anglican, he now organized a Catholic mass in the memory of Francesc Macià, a Spanish Catalan nationalist politician who had died recently. This was hugely popular among Andorrans. King Boris I, as he was now beginning to be called, had his finger on the pulse of Andorran society. The bishop didn't, the French definitely didn't, even the parliament didn't, even though they had supposedly gotten into power in a free and fair election. And so, in early July, Boris Skocyrev marched back into Andorra, surrounded by his version of the Andorran flag and supporters waving his copies of the constitution, and once again presented his demands to the parliament. Unable to resist the winds of change sweeping through the mountain valleys, they voted 23-1 to accept all of his demands. There's a few sources that claim this vote didn't actually take place, or that call into question how much of a landslide the vote really was, but it was clear that by July 10th, Skocireff was almost universally recognized within Andorra as the king. It could be people conflating his first attempt at taking power, in which the parliament threw him out, with his second, which was briefly successful. Some sources say that there were two rounds of voting. The first to consider Skocireff's proposal on July 7th, and the second to codify it into law on July 10th, both with a 23-1 tally. But what we do know is that on July 8th, after it was already well known that Skocireff was mounting another takeover attempt, the French president declared that whatever was going on in Andorra, he was going to let it happen, probably fearing another round of riots and media coverage that painted France as the bad guy if he tried to overthrow Boris. So, whether or not the 23-1 tale is true, Skocireff had gained at least some support from the Andorran parliament, largely by promising that the parliament could keep their seats and giving them much more autonomy under his system than they currently had under the co-princes. Skocireff styled himself Boris I, Prince of the Valleys of Andorra, Count of Orange and Baron of Skocireff, Sovereign of Andorra, and Defender of the Faith. Skocireff had first arrived in Andorra in December 1933. In only 7 months, he had instigated the second revolution in as many years and became king. You could say Skocireff was on a bit of a roll. And what happens to people when they're on a roll?
Don't get cocky!
They get cocky. One of Skocireff's first actions as King Boris was to declare war on the Bishop of Urgell, who, unlike the President of France, was still refusing to recognize Skocireff's claim on Andorra. Up to this point, all of his absurd, brazen gambits had been successful. How hard can it be to win a war against a Catholic bishop, with 5,000 Pyrenean peasants on your side? It's not like the bishop has a ragtag gang of revolutionaries at his disposal. And he didn't, but he did have the Spanish government on his side. And Skocireff, even though he was King of Andorra, was still living at a hotel over across the Spanish border in La Seu d'Urgell, the same town where the Bishop of Urgell lived. Everyone knew exactly where Skocireff was staying because of the constant parade of reporters up to his door. On either the 21st or 23rd of July 1934, depending on who you ask, after having reigned for either 11 or 13 days, King Boris I, Prince of the Valleys of Andorra, Count of Orange and Baron of Skocireff, Sovereign of Andorra and Defender of the Faith, was arrested by three constables and a sergeant of the Spanish National Police, which Skocireff could have anticipated and planned for by living inside the country that he was king of. But to be fair, nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. Skocireff was dragged to Madrid and unmasked as a fraud. He spent much of the remainder of his life bouncing from prison to prison, always being released briefly only to get arrested in some new country under some other strange charges. During the war, in Nazi-occupied France, he ended up in a prison camp for anti-fascists. After the war, in French-occupied Berlin, he ended up in a prison camp for fascists. He was labeled a Nazi sympathizer for the rest of his life, and it's conceivable that he really was. The German journalist Gerhard Lang wrote a book claiming that Skocireff's entire adventure in Andorra was a mission for the Third Reich. Skocireff was known for claiming he had ties to various intelligence agencies across Europe, and when he was in jail in Madrid, he received telegrams promising payment and asserting that, quote, all the documents are safe, coming from an unknown source. Lang believes that Skocireff, who had been a small-time criminal up to this point, was discovered by the Nazis and tasked with a mission to destabilize the situation in the Iberian Peninsula, distracting Europe's other powers from the rise of Nazi Germany. Fomenting a coup in Andorra would be the perfect way to do that. It would be relatively easy to gain the trust of so few people in such an uncertain time, and it would be an embarrassment to both France and Spain. Later on, Skocireff himself made claims that he had worked with the Nazis during the war, though some of them clearly seemed to be his old penchant for exaggeration breaking through. In 1982, When Skosyurev was 86 years old, living a quiet life in West Germany, he self-published a book claiming that he had been Hitler's special envoy to the Yalta Conference in 1945, and successfully persuaded the Allies not to drop an atomic bomb on Germany. In real life, no plan to nuke Germany was ever seriously considered. So, it seems that even if Skosyurev wasn't in the employ of the Nazis, he might have wished he was, which is almost worse. The liberal, somewhat democratic constitution he introduced to Andorra probably wasn't a reflection of his real interests. It was what he knew he had to support in order to gain the confidence of Andorra. But whether or not Skosyurev believed in what he promoted, Andorrans recognized he had given Andorra a damn good constitution. Fragments of it survived in the Andorran political system. Even as the old regime of the co-princes returned after Skosyurev's arrest. He was the first person to introduce the idea of Andorra as a tax haven, and after his reign, it became one. Andorra was only removed from the OECD's list of tax havens in 2014, after a new government took steps to increase transparency and bring their taxes in line with neighboring countries. Income and value-added taxes are still among the lowest in Europe, which is the main driver of Andorra's economy. In 2008, the New York Times described Andorra as, quote, a mile-high mall. Skosyurev would have been proud. The democratic elements of Skosyurev's constitution took a longer time to come. It wasn't until 1993 when Andorra adopted a constitution that reduced the co-princes to powerless figureheads, this time with the full support of France, Spain, and the Catholic Church. In practice, the rights granted in Skosyurev's constitution had been in place in Andorra since at least the 1950s, but it took almost 60 years for Andorra to officially adopt a constitution as liberal as the one the possibly fascist Russian con man king had foisted on them in 1934. Ever heard of Bir Tawil? As tiny, obscure geopolitical oddities go, Bir Tawil is kind of the opposite of Andorra. It's a flat, hot, uninhabited trapezoid of desert in between Egypt and Sudan, and it's not weird and semi-famous for having two heads of state, it's weird and semi-famous for having none. Bir Tawil is one of the world's only true pieces of terra nullius, land that is not claimed by any nation-state. The way it works is like this. Egypt and Sudan have a border dispute over the town of Halaib, which is a port on the Red Sea, and the surrounding area. Egypt claims their border with Sudan is a straight line running east-west, set by British colonists in 1900. That would put Halaib in Egypt. But Sudan claims their border is a winding path that predates the British drawn border, which puts Halaib south of the border, in Sudan. Now, most of Sudan's preferred border is north of Egypt's preferred border, but there's a place where Sudan's border drops below Egypt's border, creating a bit of territory that Egypt claims is part of Sudan, and Sudan claims is part of Egypt. That's Bir Tawil. If either country tried to claim it, it would mean recognizing the other country's claim about where their border is, and therefore renouncing their claim to Halaib. So, Bir Tawil is no man's land. It's not the only place on the planet that isn't ruled by any country. Antarctica, of course, is the biggest territory like that, but there's a treaty that says nobody can own Antarctica. There's no treaty like that about Bir Tawil, so if you tried to invade Bir Tawil and make it your own country, both Egypt and Sudan would probably shrug and say, that's the other country's problem. So, understandably, there have been a lot of attempts to take over Bir Tawil and establish a new country. By the type of people who want to rule their own country. When I won the Oregon State Geography Bee in 2014 and got to go to Washington, D.C. for the National Bee, all of the state winners did a camp out at a farm in Maryland one night, and that night we decided that we would take over Bir Tawil and proclaim it the Geographic Republic of Swagistan. It was 2014, after all, and we were middle schoolers. But I mean, to be fair, swag was a good word. Swag should unironically come back. But we'd have needed to form a Swagistani militia pretty quickly to defend our claims because there are other claimants to Bir Tawil. An Indian man, Suyash Dixit, runs a Facebook page for what he calls the Kingdom of Dixit. The person who's probably put the most effort into making Bir Tawil their own private nation is Virginia Father of Three Jeremiah Heaton, who claims to have done it because his toddler-aged daughter asked him, "Daddy, will I ever be a princess?" And he was so heartbroken by the question that he vowed to start his own country so that she could be a princess. Do you want your daughter to turn into Veruca Salt? Because that's how you get Veruca Salt. But Bir Tawil is hellish. There's no water. There's no transportation. There's no buildings. Temperatures are usually over 100 degrees. To get there, you need to pass through unstable areas, crawling with Islamic fundamentalists and other unsavory types. There's a reason nobody lives there and no real country is putting up a fight to claim it. I think the story of Boris Kosirev shows that if you really want a country to call your own, if you really want to put a numeral and titles like Defender of the Faith after your name, you don't need to hoof it out to the desert of Sudan. It's easier to take over a country than that. You just need to find an obscure little place and show up during a time of crisis. Spend some time there, shake some hands, get to know the right people, and maybe, just maybe, you can be king. If only for a little.
You've got-